by a person, anything like that, is this word to read, this Hebrew word, is used for in the Old Testament. And here, then, is it possible that the Messiah is the branch that comes from the Lord and is also the fruit that comes from the earth? The adjectives used in connection with the second part of it are just as strong as the adjectives used in connection with the first part. And we find that whether Isaiah understood this or not, he suggested the same thing over in chapter 9 of Isaiah, where he expressed rejoicing in verse 6 of chapter 9, where he said, "Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." Now that could be simply Hebrew parallelism. But the fact that you have the two terms used, and you have the difference, one is born, the child is born, one is given, the son is given, exactly parallels this here, the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth, and it is certainly reasonable to consider them as suggesting the twofold nature of Christ. He is the second person of the Trinity. He is God incarnate in human flesh. He is the branch of the Lord, but he also is man. He has a human heritage, a human background, a human lineage. He is the fruit of the earth as well as being the branch of the Lord. And so it seems to me that it is altogether reasonable to consider that we have the two aspects of Christ here predicted by Isaiah. I mention here Romans 1, 3 to 4 because the Apostle Paul brought out those two aspects so clearly there, though it is also done in many other places in the New Testament. I will just read in the King James Version those two verses. "Concerning his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was made of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness." Here we have the two aspects of the person of Christ. And so I believe we are justified in saying that we have them both here in this verse. Now we go on to a capital B, which is the divine provision for holiness. And that is unquestionably what is contained in verses 3 and 4. At this point, I might switch back to the passage. Verses 3 and 4. "And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion." You notice the daughters of Zion connect up with what we see, but doesn't necessarily mean it is the same person involved. There is a contrast between those who are punished for their sin and those who are purged by the Lord, cleansed from their sin. And this cleansing is tied right up here with their finding their joy and satisfaction through the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth. He that is left in Zion and that remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. One could take this as simply meaning that through the attacks of the enemy, through the great catastrophes they're going through, they are going to be purged and cleansed, and all who are left will be cleansed from their filth and will be finding their joy in the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth. But one can equally well say it is looking forward to a later period contrasted with this earlier period. Contrasted with the sin of Isaiah's day, there is to be a time when the Messiah, the one who is both God and man, will be the one who is wonderful and glorious, and that will be a time when the Lord will have washed away the filth of his people and purged the blood of Jerusalem by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. It does not explicitly and clearly refer to Christ's atonement, but it certainly can be considered as referring to that. Certainly there is no real cleansing at any time except in some relation to that. And so we have in this verse the these two verses, the divine provision for holiness. Then capital C, divine protection and leadership for God's pilgrims. Divine protection and leadership for God's pilgrims. There's quite a bit put into that title, and there are some things very definitely left out of it. Divine protection and leadership for God's pilgrims. We look at verses 5 to 6. The Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies. This word, assemblies, is a word that does not imply something that is continuous. It is more something that is temporary. People coming together for a meeting. Upon her assembly, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. Anyone in Isaiah's day, or in fact anyone familiar with the Bible ever since, reading those phrases, immediately thinks of the pilgrimage journey of the Israelites as they came from Egypt after being delivered from Egypt and going through the experience of the Passover there, as they were coming toward the promised land, how God put over them a cloud and smoke by day and a flaming fire by night to guide them and to protect them. You remember when they came to the Red Sea, that the Lord caused that it should give them light, but that it should hide them from the Egyptian forces which had followed them and were intending to try to destroy them. It gave them both leadership and protection. And so here we have a reference back to the Exodus, to the pilgrimage journey of the Israelites when God led and protected them, and it is stated that there will be a similar protection for them, a similar leading for them, and upon all the glory shall be a defense. I don't know why the King James Version used this word defense at this particular place. The word is only translated defense once in the King James Version. It is translated chamber once and closet once. It is derived from a verb which would seem to mean that which closes something in and protects it. It is translated canopy in the New American Standard, for instance. And it is a word which seems to suggest a sort of a temporary kind of a protection. And that idea is still further brought out in the next verse. There shall be a tabernacle for a shadow. Now this word tabernacle in the Bible doesn't mean something put up to hold evangelistic service. This word tabernacle does not necessarily have in itself a religious significance. But it does have the significance of something temporary. Very often in the Old Testament, the King James used the word tabernacle to translate the word ohel, which means a tent. But in this case, it is not that. It is the word sukkah, which means a booth. It is used where Jonah put up a little temporary structure to protect himself from the sun. It is used, the Feast of Booths is a feast, they also call it Feast of Tabernacles. It is a time when among modern Orthodox Jews, they often in their backyard put up a little temporary thing of branches and leaves to remind them of the wilderness journey and of the way God protected them as they went through. It is a temporary place, not a permanent place of living. There will be a booth for a shadow in the daytime from the heat and for a place of refuge and for a cover from storm and from rain. Here is divine leadership and divine protection. People thought of as pilgrims, but people who have been cleansed through the one who is both God and man. These people are here protected from the dangers that are round about them. They are protected from the storm, from the rain, from the heat of the sun. It is quite different from chapter 2. I asked you in the assignment last time to note what verses in this chapter show the removal of external danger. And in this chapter, I do not find any verse that shows removal of external danger. That is the clear emphasis in chapter 2. There is to be a period of complete removal of external danger. God has promised that. We can look forward to it. We can know it is going to come. But in this case, we have something quite different. We have dangers round about. We have recurring dangers. We do not have a permanent dwelling. We have temporary abodes, but we have God's protection and God's leadership to those who have been cleansed by the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment. And so it would seem to me that one must say that verses 4-6 cannot look forward, let's say verses 3-6, cannot look forward to the millennium, but must look forward to a time when God's people are being particularly protected by Him, a time when these people have been cleansed by the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment. If we had only verses 3-6, we might very well say this refers to God's protection of Israel at some time during its history subsequent to the time of Isaiah. In view of the fact that it is so closely connected with verse 2, which predicts the glory of the one who is both the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth, it would seem to me to be still more reasonable to say that it looks forward to those who find in Him their glory and satisfaction. That it looks forward to them as they carry on their earthly journey in the midst of danger, of persecution, of difficulty and trouble, that God will give them guidance, leadership, and protection, whatever comes, just as He did to the Israelites as they go through the wilderness. Now, as between these two interpretations, I would not wish to be dogmatic. If we did not have verse 2, if we only had verses 3-6, I would say that I could not decide between the two. I would not know which of the two it might be. In view of verse 2, it seems to me it is pretty hard to escape the conclusion that, as Peter said, they are looking forward to Christ and to the glory that should fall. And that he's looking forward here not to the consummated glory of the millennium or of the period that follows the millennium, but looking forward to the time of the pilgrim's journey. So I think at this point we can go on to chapter 5. And in chapter 5, seems to me the most important thing as we approach chapter 5 is to note that there is an important division in the chapter. The first, while there is the general subject of the whole chapter, is rebuke for sin and declaration of coming punishment. While that is the theme of the chapter as a whole, nevertheless, it is true that the first 7 verses deal with one specific parable or picture. And this picture is not referred to again in the chapter. There is no further reference to the Lord's vineyard or the Lord's treatment of his vineyard. So while the whole chapter is dealing with God's condemnation of sin, of his people, verses 1 to 7 form a definite unit by themselves. And I was disappointed to find some who in the assignment would say make one part, two parts, maybe three parts of 1 to 7 and then go on 4, 5, 6, 7 and so on. Because there's such an important division there that it seems to me that it should have a Roman numeral one with subnotes under it, rather than to have subdivisions of it parallel with subdivisions of what follows. We make a division there, definitely. Now from verse 8 on, direction I have suggested to you in looking at all the prophetic books, is he dealing with rebuke? Is he dealing with blessing for God's people? I think that the greater part of the prophetic book falls under one of these two heads. And all of this falls under the head of rebuke. But under the subject of rebuke, we have material that deals particularly with pointing to the sin and declaring God's unhappiness with the sin, his rebuke for the sin, his urging people to turn away from it. And we have passages in which he specifically predicts punishment for sin. Now, in this chapter, the last part is very definitely dealing with punishment for sin, verses 24 to 30. We have in those verses, 24 to 30, it is entirely dealing with punishment for sin. The fact that verse 25 ends with a phrase that is used as the end of several stanzas of a poem later in the book of Isaiah leads people easily to think that there's an important break after verse 25. But actually, the subject matter of verse 25 and that of the verses that follow are very closely related. From 24 on through, he is telling how God is going to cause that there shall be great misery come to the land when a fierce people, wildly aggressive people attacks with tremendous roaring like a lion and roars against them like the roaring of the sea. And if you look to the land, you behold darkness and sorrow. So that from there on is punishment, from verse 24 on. But in the part from verse 8 to 23, you have largely rebuke for sin, but you also have certain verses that deal with punishment. Verses 9 to 10, for instance, 9 and 10, after telling in verse 8 about the wrong of covetousness and selfishness, trying to build up tremendous estates, he then goes on to say that many houses will become desolate without inhabitants, and that the land will produce very, very little. That is definitely punishment. Then you go on with various types of sin, rebuke, and in verses 13 to 17, again, you have punishment for the sin. Therefore, my people are gone into captivity. Does this describe what happened in Isaiah's day when many people were taken by Sennacherib into captivity? Or does it look forward to the future day when the whole nation will go? We cannot say. And of course, in English, we would translate it a little differently depending which way we take it. But it doubtless includes both. Just as the final verses of the chapter may look forward to the Assyrian conquest, but may also include other later conquests and attacks. One thing that makes some think that the latter part does not refer to the Assyrian conquest is the use of the phrase many nations. But the Assyrians had conquered many nations and had their forces made up of people from many nations. So it could conceivably refer to the Assyrian conquest. It could refer to the Babylonian conquest. It could refer to the Persian conquest later, or the coming of the Hellenistic Empire, or to the great Roman forces, which were made up of people from many nations under Roman control. So that there's nothing, no conclusive proof that one would be wrong who would say that the last few verses of the chapter are pointing forward to a terrible catastrophe for Israel toward the end of the age. That is not impossible, but there's nothing in the passage that requires it. It could point forward to matters that have already happened. Is some of these woes in this chapter against particular sins, I think, are very appropriate to our day. Look at verse 20. Woe to them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. What a picture of the relativity of our present day when people use words in the exact opposite sense to the way that they are usually taken. I see it's time to quit, but I just mentioned that this first parable of the Lord's vineyard is the background of a parable that our Lord gave in the New Testament, which is quoted in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and therefore is special interest for us in connection with the New Testament. And next time, the first half hour, we'll have a little test on what we've had thus far, and then we will continue.